So I'm Chris Robay. I'm from the States.
Hi,
you can't tell from my accent. Thank you all for coming. This space is awesome. Thank you, Maria, and all the other people, I'm sure, behind the scenes who've been doing this, so I appreciate it. I'm from New Jersey, and I speak quickly, so I'll try not to. And tell me to slow down, or if you want me to say something again. By all means, right? I'll try to, like, give you the truncated version of this thing, because it can go for, like, an hour, because I like to show a lot of videos and stuff. So I'm a film professor down in South Florida, and I wrote this book, you know, Breaking the Spell, which is on sale back there. And basically, you know, I wrote it largely because it didn't exist, right? A book like this kind of needed to be written, which I'll go into, like, what it exactly does, right? But really it came out of, like, I have a lot of friends who are filmmakers in the activist scene, and either, you know, they fit one of two roles. Either they're self-defined media makers who are just sympathetic to the left, whatever that might mean, like a broad sense of the left, anarchists, socialists, whatever. And then I have other people who don't self-define as filmmakers or media makers, but they use media in their activism, right? They're grassroots organizers and activists, and they use it that way. So the more I talk to them, you know, they didn't know the history of this stuff, of video activism, basically. So the more I spoke to them, the more it became apparent that this was needed. So one thing, you know, I wrote this book for predominantly is for them, people who make, you know, do media activism, either self-defined people who, you know, consider themselves video activists, or just people who are involved in activism but need to use media, right, in that way. So that was that. I should do a shout-out. There was a book in the 80s that came out by this guy, John Downey, called Radical Media, 1984, and he kind of does this kind of survey of global media and anarchist kind of inflected media at that time. But really, that's the last time any kind of book of this scope has kind of come out. So that's partially why the book's so big, because I wanted to chronicle anarchist inflected video activism from the 60s to the present. So that's it. There's a couple ways in which I approach it, which I won't go too much into, but I just wanted to focus upon. One is, like, when I'm in film and media studies, as I said, and people tend to write about, like, certain groups, you know, that do media activism. So there's a lot out there that way, but nobody really shows how these groups connect together historically or geographically, right? Nobody looks at the in-between moments. And it's really important to show the in-between moments because that's where stuff's being done, you know? Even just a recent example of something like Occupy. I was in Montreal, like, a month or so ago for Anarchist Film Festival, and I was talking about the book and other, you know, media makers. And I met a lot of people, like, younger in their 20s, who got politicized out of Occupy, right? And in the States, at least, Occupy, by the mass media, is kind of considered a failure, right? That it came, you know, burst on the scene in 2011, kind of did its thing for a year or two, and then went away. But as you guys probably know, like, if you're involved in activism, Occupy was immensely important, right? And has reverberations to the present now. Like, in other words, first it shifted the terms of the debate, right, at the time in the States about talking about austerity and talking about poverty and things that we weren't really talking about. But, and two, it rejuvenated people who are already involved in activism. But three, it got engaged a whole new slew of people in activism that I'd never seen before. And as I've been touring around with this book, more and more people I come across have been that way. Like, this was my first time getting engaged. So the book goes up basically to that, you know, up to Occupy, and sort of, like, hints towards what's going on in cop watching, which I'll sort of end my talk with, in the States. But I think it's a really important thing for, like, people who do this research and stuff to look at now. Like, what's bubbling after Occupy kind of has dissolved, but all these new networks of people happen, right? Because if your ear's to the ground, you can see a lot of activism going on behind the scenes. And I should say, even when I started the book, I started in 2008, and it was a pretty low point, right? Then, in the States particularly, we had George Bush, you know, a bunch of time. We had Deepwater Horizon. We had just a bunch, we had the economic crash happening. Just shit was awful. In the United States, it was a low point. People were reflecting back on, like, whatever happened to indie media, if you remember that came out in 1999. Yeah. So a lot of people who were part of the movement, it was the 10-year anniversary in 2009, were just like, what happened, right? We had this massive altered globalization movement, and, you know, it seemed on the wane. And then, lo and behold, you know, the Arab Spring happens, the kind of Mediterranean summer, and then Occupy, right, just kind of emerged midway into this. So it just kind of suggests, right, the ways in which these linkages happen. So, one, it's important to track that type of thing, those linkages. The other thing, too, I'll just highlight and then move on kind of the main premises of the book, is my, where I come from, the research I do, since I'm a film and media studies scholar, we tend to fetishize objects like film, the film or the video or whatnot. And for me, to understand like media activism, it's really important to start to understand media as a practice, not a thing. Right? So I'll say it again. We have to understand media not as a thing, but as an activity, as a verb, not a noun. Because when we start with it as a noun, we look at the object and then fill in the background later. But anybody knows who deals with video activism, it's really, the activism is only a small part of a wider stretch of activism going on the ground itself. So we need to understand what are the goals of the groups and the movements going on, and how does this media come out of it, right? How does it become an organic thing? So you have to reverse your perspective of what's going on. So I have like three main premises in the book, and I try to adjust this because you guys, electricity and everything's different than ours, so I think I've kind of arranged it well enough for it, but I can't do it perfectly. Let me just see if I can. Yeah. So one of them here is, I should say this too, why I started in the 60s, right, is... Of course, media has always been a form of activist practice. So one thing I wanted to highlight here, the first premise is video activism is just not a form of representational practice. In other words, it's not just important what it represents, who we see, how we see them, and whatnot. Though that's important, right? That's a really important aspect. But also that the media making itself, the distribution, the production, the exhibition, is a form of activist practice itself, right? So in other words, when people screen this stuff, they use it as a form of coalition building. It's not just to get an audience in there, see the stuff, and then leave, but actually organize around the viewings itself, right? And actually mobilize around them. And one thing I just want to be clear, of course, media making has served this purpose ever since media making began. So you can go back to like the Soviet Union in the 20s, and Lenin theorizes, the use of a newspaper as a form of organizing. You can go to Sergei Eisenstein, the famous Soviet director who did it. But what changes in the 60s is media making becomes much more available to a mass, more large amount of people, right? We can think of the underground press as being an example of this with offset printing, which suddenly you can make newspapers for $5. You can put out like 500 of them. So what happens is a quantitative difference leads to a qualitative difference, right? Meaning that because this becomes more available to people in the West in particular, that becomes more integral to their kind of activist practices. And I'll get into sort of the problems with that too, but that's one, right? So it's a form of activist practice itself as well as representation. Two, which probably appeals to a lot of people here, and I really felt we were neglectful of this, that a lot of it's anarchist inflected, right? For some reason, when people write about media activism, anarchism's never mentioned, right? It really ticked me off when I was like studying Occupy. It was never mentioned, like, majority of Occupies were anarchist-inflected organizations, right? For whatever reason, right? I don't entirely understand why that was, and I'm really curious if you guys have anything to say about it. But so when I say anarchist-inflected, I'm thinking of three things. And I don't mean capital A, like, in other words, people self-identify as anarchists necessarily, though some do, right? But I mean, like, kind of low A, lowercase A anarchist, right? In other words, regardless if they're aware of it or not, they're nonetheless incorporating anarchist practices. So what are they, right? It could be consensus-based decision-making, one, right, that they're doing, so it's not a majority vote, but everybody has to kind of come to consensus in terms of what they're doing. Two could be they're aspiring to be non-hierarchical leadership, right? So they might have leadership positions, but they rotate them, or they don't have leadership positions or whatnot, or they're very cognizant of it. And then the third thing is that they're direct action-oriented, right? So in other words, they want to enact the change they want to see now, right? As you all, as this place is, right? In other words, if you want a non-hierarchical society, you don't wait for it to happen. You start, right? You start creating it in your very practices that you're dealing with. So they deal with, like, one of three of these things. It doesn't necessarily mean they successfully do it, as we all know, right? We aspire to these things, to be non-hierarchical. We aspire to be consensus-based. We aspire to do direct action doesn't necessarily mean we're kind of successful at it. And this is obvious. I mean, other scholars have said stuff like this. This is a major movement that occurs in the 60s with just social movement organizing. It moves from a Leninist type of structure to much more anarchist-inflected type of thing. So, you can think of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right, SNCC, that were doing the lunch counter strikes and kind of the voting rights organizing in the South. They were anarchist-inflected, right? They all were consensus-based decision-making. They were direct action. Like, in other words, if you want to see the end of racism in the South, you have black people sit up right at the front of the lunch counters where they're not supposed to sit, right? You don't wait for somebody to pass the law, you actually have people sit there, get them arrested, and draw it into the forefront itself. So it's really important, I argue, even when groups are unaware of this, I think they're responding to kind of anarchist-inflected stuff. And like I said, some groups are more self-identified. Like, I know Franklin Lopez, I don't know if you're following, he does this show called The End of the World as We Know It. He's called the, he's known as the, well, anyway, he ended the show, but he's a big guy up in Canada who self-identifies. And then lesser-known places, like, or more known, Paper Tiger TV, that comes out of New York City, never would self-identify as anarchists, but they have anarchist principles that guide their thing through. And then the final thing, and that this type of activism particularly highlights the contradictory nature of itself, right? That it's both fighting against capitalism and its strains, and also is indebted to it, right? In other words, its very technology comes out of multinational corporations, such as Sony itself. And in many ways, this speaks to our own contradictions, all of us who are, like, you know, involved in social movement organizing and whatnot, of addressing those kind of contradictions, right? And so when I've approached, I did about 100 interviews for the book that just came out, and I'm still interviewing people for new stuff that I'm doing. I was really upfront with them about it. I'm like, I'm not here to glorify you. I'm not here, right? I'm not here to, like, just do celebratory stuff of what you're doing, but I'm here to be sympathetic. I'm an organizer, too. I've been involved in social movement organizing a long time. I'm part of my union. I'm a university professor. So that's part colored my way in which I approach the people who I went to. In other words, like, I'm an organizer, too. So I can kind of get the difficulties that you're engaged in. But I'm not here to celebrate you. I'm not here to tear you down either, right? I'm here just to understand your struggle and get into all those kind of things. So the way the book progresses, it goes from the 60s to the present, and each decade it looks like a primary group or groups that sort of do a major movement change. So the 70s, it looks at public access television and cable television, which in many ways is the forefront then. In the 80s, it looks at satellite television and sort of what was going on then. And then the 90s to 2000s is looking at the internet, right, of how that's being utilized and whatnot. So I wanted to address these contradictions. So, you know, part of me, I'll just start at the beginning of the book. Sorry. To the 1960s and 70s. So, you know, just the very emergence of video activism shows kind of these contradictions, meaning that it comes out in the late 60s, early 70s, because the Sony Portapak comes out in 1967. It's the first kind of consumer available type of thing. So let me just get at, first of all, the availability of the stuff first happens at, guess where? The most privileged nations in the in the world, the United States and Canada. Why? Because they have the biggest consumer market for this stuff. So already, right, the availability of this technology reinscribes a kind of colonial mapping of the world, right, of the availability itself. So we should be aware of that, right? It takes a while, much longer. It takes till the 70s and whatnot, and the early 80s to get to Europe, and still takes much longer to get to South America and whatnot. So, right, the very availability of it, you know, reinscribes certain problematics. And even within these countries, I should say, at the time, it was about $1,500 to $2,000 to purchase this equipment. But what made it so much better than film was, film, as you know, you could have an 8mm projector, and that's not that hard to purchase, but buying film and processing it, right, and cutting it and then developing it, it's really a highly expensive thing. Video activism, on the other hand, you lay out all your money in the front end, but then it's cheap after that, right? You have a videotape, you can record over it multiple times, right? It's not, right, once you put the outlay. So to purchase this stuff, mostly it was done by collectives, right, at this time in the early, the late 60s, early 70s. Not coincidentally, who are these collectives? Largely white, middle-class people in the States and in Canada that could purchase this stuff. So this stuff was largely not available to people of color and working-class groups until we get to, like, the late 80s and the early 90s itself. So, so anyway, that was one thing, of a sense that not only in terms of globally is it being reinscribing a colonial mindset, but even within the nations that it is, it's privileging the middle class that largely gets access to this first of all. So I'll just briefly go into New York City is where one place that becomes a hub. And this isn't often talked about either because we tend to romanticize this type of technology. And there's a recent, I shouldn't talk shit about a recent movie, but I will, about the video guerrillas, which is good in some ways, but it's a very romanticized version of the video guerrillas. In other words, suddenly these guys, people come together and they magically get this equipment and blah, 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 you know, what happens. And really, there's a lot of structural reasons of why this happens in New York City. It also happens in San Francisco, which I won't go into here, but I'll just talk about New York City, because there's a slew of different things that allow these people to do it. First of all, as I mentioned before, is the privilege of the people themselves, right? They were white, middle-class folks that had access to money and privilege in ways that other groups did not itself. And one group, which I'm not going to talk about, but was called the Video Freaks. You know, they were teamed up with CBS that was sort of interested in this type of new equipment. And believe it or not, they teamed up to do the show called Subject to Change, which they actually did live, and it never got broadcast because it was considered too like controversial and whatnot. I won't go into why. But as a result of that whole process, they stole all the equipment that they got from CBS and took it with them and never got fucking charged. Right? Now that speaks of privilege there that would not happen to most other groups, right, where you just take the equipment suddenly that CBS gives you. But what also made New York City kind of an ideal place, one, unlike nowadays, cheap rent, right, that existed back then in the 60s and 70s. So you didn't have to pay that much money for it. And if you know New York City, it's a very condensed area, right? So you can easily get together with one another in ways that is not pragmatic across the rest of the United States. That was one. Two, the New York State Council of Arts was offering a massive amount of money to actually support this type of activism that all these activists tapped into. And I have the stats here, just to give you a sense of, like, U.S. money at the time. Not to bore you with it, but, so, they had access to, here we go. In 1970, it's 1971, right? This is the New York State Council on the Arts. They're offering over $20 million of grants for this activity. 1970, 1971, $20 million for people doing this work, right? Which all these people tapped into. This is never usually spoken about. I just have it here. In 1974, this went up to $34 million, right? This is absolutely unheard of. This actually totally gets decimated in the 80s by Reagan, right? As you can imagine. But there's this moment of possibility that's absolutely amazing in terms of what happens in terms of the state support of itself. And then three, right, is it's New York City. It draws a lot of talent, right, of people like going to New York City. Like, it's a media hub, so it draws people naturally who's going to do this stuff. So the low affordable rent, the high, you know, the way in which people live together, the strong support by the state, as well as just drawing a lot of talent there, really opened up ways in which it would. Even though a lot of these groups self-identified as anarchists, they totally realized how they were being hypocritical, right? They were taking state money in many ways and whatnot, and so they were kind of engaged in this. So one group I want to talk about briefly is People's Video Theater that only existed for a brief amount of time. And this is true for a lot of the groups, that they didn't, you know, they existed for 2 or 3 years. They were there from 1970 to 1972. And what makes them so interesting is, yeah, there were three white guys largely that ran People's Video Theater, but they were actually actively trying to do outreach with other groups, and they were using video trying to mediate conflict. Meaning what? So, for example, down in the village, the Greenwich Village in downtown Manhattan, because of beginning gentrification, African-American folk and local Jewish folk were coming into conflict with one another, right? The way in which the neighborhoods were sort of merging. So what People's Video Theater would do is they'd go down there with their video cameras and talk to various residents, black and white, black and Jewish, and film them, right? What are your issues? What are your issues? What are your issues? And then a couple days later, they would host a public event where they'd invite all the people who they spoke to in the community to come there and watch the videotapes of one another and create a discussion around it afterwards to mediate the kind of conflict, which had a really major impact, actually, in this place. Because not only were people hearing other people's, you know, concerns unmediated, they talked for 20 minutes. If you know a lot of this video, I'm going to show you some of it. There's very little cutting going on there, right? It's like very, and there's both a pragmatic reason and an aesthetic reason for that. Pragmatically, you can't see what you're cutting, right? You're blind. You'd actually have to, like, watch it on the monitor, stop it, cut it, and then try to put it together, right? Which made it really hard to put it together. But also, a lot of these people who were making this video wanted stuff to naturally unfold, and they felt like cutting was arbitrarily them selecting stuff, so they wanted to have the camera there and capture it as it was. So one, people would hear other people speak, as well as, equally important, is hearing themselves speak, right? Suddenly reflecting on their own selves of what they're saying stupidly or smartly at that moment made them have a step back to have this thing. It was such a successful moment that they were invited to South Orange, New Jersey, the People Video Theater, that were also having conflicts between two. The mayor of South Orange invited them there to actually mediate this type of conflict, too. So they were trying to get out this equipment, right? Perhaps the most interesting thing, they were trying to create ties to the Young Lords, right? The Young Lords is a group that starts coming out in the late 60s, early 70s. They start in Chicago. They're not identical to the Black Panthers, but they're somewhat analogous to it. In other words, right, the Black Panthers are trying to create a sense of autonomy and self-determination among African-American folk, surveilling the police, as well as trying to create kind of, they wouldn't call it, it's essentially anarchist grassroots organizations, right? Free breakfast programs, free needle exchanges, health programs itself, free food, etc. So Puerto Rican groups were doing this, such as the Young Lords. And the New York City chapter, which forms in 69, becomes very big, right? So People's Video Theater starts getting, in contact with them and wants to loan them out equipment. So I want to show a brief sequence here where you can kind of see the Young Lords, how they use this community. It'll give you a feel for this, in terms of this kind of early video. It's very raw, and in some way they liked that a lot, I should also say. This early video practice that. They liked it being unaesthetic, right? Like being just a down and dirty type of technology. And I should say a big thing for a lot of these groups, too, was unlike film, right, where you film somebody, you have no idea what's on the film until you actually develop it and put it together. With video, most of these groups, or many of them, would film the people and then show it to them immediately afterwards. So if you had problems with that, they would immediately erase it, right? So you gain a sense of trust that way of this thing called feedback, right? So that's how you suddenly engage the groups you're with, because you can immediately show back this type of thing. So I just want to show a sequence here. Actually, I had it queued up somewhere else, but I'm just going to pull it to where it needs to be. This is a gay rights march, which is interesting too, I should say. But I'm just going to pull it to the Lords here. And this is Denise Oliver, who you're going to see. Here we go. This is when they occupied a church in, they occupy a church briefly, a local church within the east side of Harlem, because they feel like they're not being represented by the church, so they just take it over and create this people's church. And the backstory of this is the second time they've occupied it, one of their people has been, well, he died in prison, and they're pretty certain that he was killed, but they don't know it. But this is Denise Oliver speaking, and you can get a sense of how they filmed her at this time.
Sale was arrested for attempted first-degree arson. He was charged with trying to burn down the building that we live in. Which doesn't make any sense at all, of course. And everyone knows that. But the police, of course, were using. They busted him along with our field secretary. The field secretary has been doing a lot of organizing in the community, so that's probably why he was busted. He was organizing toward our October 30th demonstration at UN. So that when they got in there, the bail was $3,000 altogether, which of course we didn't have. So we couldn't get them out, and we were going to have to raise it. And during the time we were raising the bail, he was killed. He was murdered.
Where was he?
He was in the tours. So he was on the 8th floor, which is the observation area for psychiatrics and everywhere other. And supposedly would take. Now you know that they're supposed to take your shoes and your belt away from you, right? Especially if it's going to be on the psychiatric floor, because they put all political prisoners there. Political reasons are crazy. So what went down is that it was garroted by a belt, strangled. There's a difference between hanging yourself and being strangled by someone else. We know that for your love life, he was a revolutionary, and revolutionaries don't commit suicide. It's not just a question of who you are, it's a question of all the brothers and sisters in those jails that whenever they die, they say they hung up. They don't even prove it, they just say it. And that whenever they kill anybody from being too hard, they say they hung up. That whenever anybody dies in malpractice, maltreatment, or anything else in there, they say they hung up. And we're tired of that. We know that our people are not that suicidal. Our people love life. And they're not into that. I'm like, okay, there might have been one out of 100 of those deaths might be a suicide. What about the other 99? What about all of the conditions in there where prisoners don't get medical treatment, where prisoners don't get good food, where prisoners, all the things that those brothers ran down? None of the demands have been met by the city. They were promised by Mayor Lindsay himself,
So I'm just going to stop there, but you get a feel for it, right? It's largely uncut. It's very grainy. You can even feel the way they're experimenting with the camera while they're filming her, like this low angle shot. So that I should say that, too. A lot of the people who got engaged with video activism originally in the 60s and early 70s did not have a background in film or media making, largely. It was more rare to have that. So that was also the enabling thing of this type of activism. You didn't have to have a background in media making to do it. An interesting side note here is that People's Video Theater does give the Lords some equipment eventually, and nothing comes out of it. The Lords just take it and kind of go their own way. There was no kind of there was no kind of community building across the different groups itself. And like I said, they burnt out rather quickly. They end in 72, which is roughly actually the Lords too start self-imploding around that time. So what I want to do is kind of bring it up more to the present, right? In other words, you can see from this early time that there's always been this goal to try to get access to more marginalized groups with video equipment, as well as films, I should say. There's a lot of filmmakers. In the 60s and 70s, right, a lot of filmmakers, such as groups as Newsreel, that comes out of New York City, and I start the book off with this, but I'm just not going to speak about it here. But we're trying to get access to various working class communities or disenfranchised communities itself, right, to actually represent their struggles. And same with video, too. Now, what happens, although it's somewhat a cliche, you know, as you know, and as corporations constantly tell us, this technology does become more accessible, which is true. It does, right? In other words, it doesn't become accessible to everybody. I want to get into sort of the problems of this kind of myth that just because it's accessible, then suddenly we can do everything with it, right, which we can't do. But it clearly, when you study kind of the historical terrain, video has gotten more access to people who have not had access to it before. And I would like to end eventually on cop watching, which is sort of the most interesting thing going on now in terms of this type of media activism. But before that, you know, I'd like to go to this group called Media Mobilizing Project. I should say I'm friends with this group now, so I've sort of like, you know, take it however you want. When I first started with it, I was not friends with them. I've co-written with some of the founders of the movement. It's out of Philadelphia, and it's really focused on the outer Philadelphia area. I just want to be accurate here when it actually started. And you'll see this too. This is really, I should just say this as a thing too. In terms of accessibility to actual marginal groups of color or working class groups, this technology has only become available in the last 5 or 6 years, right? I mean, there's this myth it became available, and of course in select communities it did, you know? I mean, throughout the 70s, Canada had access to indigenous groups up there. Certain South American groups had in the 80s, but this was the exception rather than the rule, right? The thing that's changed in the last 5 or 6 years, now, at least in the West, right, in the Western world, this has become much more accessible to working class communities and certain disenfranchised communities. But once again, I want to get into sort of the issues of that. Prior to it, and like it's with the founding of Media Mobilizing Project, which starts in 2005, it's pretty representative that the founders of Media Mobilizing, although diverse racially speaking, we have African-American, Indian in terms of India type of person, as well as white, they're all middle-class people who actually found this organization and Media Mobilizing Project. But the interesting thing about this group is their whole goal was to engage local communities with this technology and have them become the new leaders of the group. So I kind of got engaged with them in 2009, interviewing itself. And I should say, they are an outgrowth of two earlier strains in Philadelphia, right? One, Philadelphia Indie Media, which I won't go into too much, but you know, Indie Media emerged in 1999 in Seattle in many ways, right? It was the first, and this is so hard to comprehend, but right, there was no social media there, right, at that time. So Indie Media does the radical thing of suddenly making people available to post videos, photographs, journalism online for the first time ever, right? I mean, this is just amazing. And also, I should say, that they didn't track you on the site of Indie Media, right? There was no tracking of, like, cookies or whatnot. So whatever you put up there was anonymous. So when the feds busted Indie Media, the federal police busted Indie Media groups, there was no tracking of who was belonged to. And that did happen. Servers were confiscated in the United States in the early 2000s itself. But it was a majorly galvanizing thing. And I'll just briefly say with Seattle, you know, in 1990, because it is such a watershed moment, right, of, you know, the World Trade Organization occurs. It actually does get successfully shut down by the 40,000 people or so there. But Indie Media is major in that moment in that they start scooping the story over the regular coverage from, like, our big news people, like CBS, NBC, ABC. In other words, they're starting to chronicle police violence in ways that the actual corporate media is not chronicling. And because the corporate media is embarrassed of getting scooped, they start suddenly reporting it. right? So actually a bunch of ragtag grassroots people, because of their coverage, start shifting actually the way in which the story is being done on the ground by the corporate media, right? And it scares the shit out of the corporate media in many ways. And I'll just say, just as a brief aside, a lot of the people who started indie media, guess what they started founding? WikiLeaks, Twitter, Facebook, Twitter, right? They're involved in a lot of these other things that eventually emerge in social media in very problematic ways, right, that we could kind of talk about. So one, Philly indie media, and that was a really unique scene, and it hasn't been written about, but I just know people from there. It was a very working class scene. Unlike most of the indie medias, I'm very middle class and kind of college educated. Philly was very much focused on working class. And if you all know Philadelphia, if you've ever been there, it's a very working class city, so this isn't necessarily surprising. And then the other big thing that helped found Media Mobilizing Project was various working class organizations like Jobs for Justice and stuff like that that consistently worked with working class groups. So I should say, when Media Mobilizing Project was founded, it didn't come out of nowhere. It already fostered a lot of relationships with these various groups that they were focusing on, such as cab drivers, security officers, working class students going to Temple and whatnot itself. So I want to focus on one thing in particular that Media Mobilizing Project did, and I'm going to show like a little sequence of a video here from it. Let me just get the date right here correctly, too. So they started organizing cab drivers in the early 2000s, and if you know, cab driving is probably one of the worst professions to organize around, right? In that all these guys are fighting one another for money, right? So it's a very cutthroat profession. Like, you see yourself as against your fellow colleague because that person's going to take your money from you, that's going to get the next ride, right? So organizing cab drivers is a deeply problematic thing. And Media Mobilizing Project makes this kind of argument. In a neoliberal economy, right, particularly in the West, where service industries have started thriving, right? So like cab drivers, service workers, people who work over, media has to become the new spot. Media making has to be the new spot where you start organizing around. Because our workplaces are being fragmented by digital technology and not seeing one another anymore, right? Unlike Marx, you know, back in the 19th and early 20th century, where, you know, industrial jobs would bring people together and you could organize on those spots, that's no longer true anymore, right? At least in the West, right? Like, obviously, the industrial economy is really big in China and stuff like that, and it's different. But in the West, because a service-based economy happened, we're much more fragmented, and it's much more difficult for us to organize. So what Media Mobilizing Project does is use media making to draw not only singular groups together, like cab drivers, but then have various groups of working class communities meet one another afterwards to actually start organizing with one another and create a sense of solidarity with one another itself. So the cab drivers, and I interviewed a lot of them and spoke to them. There was a multimedia kind of campaign that they did, right? The first, and they were smart about it, like, they figured, you know, first of all, what's the most important media for cab drivers? Can you imagine? Does anybody want to guess, like, in terms of, what would the most important media cab drivers have?
Papers, newspapers.
Radio.
There. The radio, right? Because you're in your bloody cab for, like, 8 or 9 hours a day, yeah? So that's the first thing they create is a labor justice radio thing, right? They create a radio, not a radio station, but a program itself that cab drivers can listen to and start enumerating their issues, right? And there's a bunch of issues going on in terms of companies not wanting to give them GPS coordinate things in their things, violence at night occurring to them, fares not raising accordingly, so on and so forth. So the first thing was that, right? They did do a newspaper, right? They did do a website, too, but generally people didn't have access. One of the big things that they did, though, is they created a video, a short video with one another when they started trying to unionize, right? They teamed up with the Taxi Workers Alliance out in New York City that did successfully unionize a couple years prior. So with their thing, Media Mobilizing Project, and a lot of these cab drivers would tell me this story, right, in that they were already trying to organize for a union, but they had no kind of sense of tactics, right? In other words, well, as one guy told me, he's like, we go in a corner with our picket signs and just kind of yell and not know what the fuck we're doing, right? And suddenly kind of like disperse. So Media Mobilizing, what they did is to make them strategize about it more, right? How do you bring the media into this, right? How do you better present yourself and whatnot? So what happens is, 3 or 4 cab drivers they bring into the organization to make this film about organizing before the vote for unionization occurs. And they create it, right? They create this thing called Taxi Work, A New Era, which I want to show a sequence from. And what they did with this is they would first of all put out mobile projectors in all the cab stands across the city and project this video to cab drivers while they're waiting for actual you know, people to come in. So they'd be kind of familiarized with the, They'd also go to the airport and project it, because that's where a majority of the cab drivers go to pick up people to bring them into Center City, Philadelphia. As well as they distributed it to local congresspeople in the Philadelphia Capitol to see the stuff and sort of what was going on. So I want to show a sequence, the beginning and kind of the end of this thing. And you get a sense, too, of how well put together it is. And at the beginning, it'll give you a sense of sort of the alienating nature of cab driving, being alone, being, you know, by yourself, and so on and forth. And the end, you'll notice, has a much more kind of collective sense of, you know, them coming together. And like I said, this was primarily for them, right? Many people outside of Media Mobilizing Project and the cab drivers did not see this, except them, and it helped them mobilize. So, oops, sorry. So let me just pull it up. Oops. One sec. Oh, wrong one.
Discovered that solidarity transcends the law and power comes from unity. Power is not granted by the law. Organized workers define their own lives and their own conditions. You found your way around the law. You found a way to act collectively, to fight, to improve your wages and working conditions, and to lift up your families.
This is a new era for the taxi industry and labor as a whole. Taxi drivers in the new era began to organize nationally and internationally, holding a founding conference of the International Taxi Works Alliance in February of 2007, suffering from the same problems like high fines, no meter increase, forced GPS, and credit card system. Taxi drivers came together to come up with common solutions to find what worked and what didn't work in other cities.
No boss. No priest, no rabbi, no politician, no union leader will do anything for you. We are a self-help movement. You organize yourselves, you create the standard, you make the fight, and you have a union, and you're part of a movement. It is part of our tradition. Nobody gave us anything. Nobody. Nobody gave us anything. We took it.
Let me just fast forward. Well, actually, so the Create Coalition's here. You can see a bunch of other groups are supporting the cab drivers here. Jobs for Justice and stuff. All right, let me just go to the end here. So I recommend you see it online. It's available. There we go.
We did a lot of good little story also.
Well, the campaign officially starts this minute. You campaign, I campaign.
This election was a historic first for cab drivers in the nation. Just to see the fairness of it, to have the National Lawyer Guilds involved, and to have it documented by the Media Mobilizing Project was an incredible feat for labor.
Nobody sees who you voted for.
You're going to work in this country,
right? I believe that the organization of this type will be able to help us as cab drivers within the entire city. So anything that it would take for this objective to be implemented fairly, so that there will be no misunderstanding or dispute among us, I'd like to be a witness to, because it is historical so far, as far as I can see.
Ohio. okay? So no matter who wins, please just come together and stick with that guy. Not no more two unions. We can't afford that anymore, guys. That killed us. One unified taxi union. No matter what we call it, let's not break off anymore, guys, because this is what's killing us. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and he's going to give the results.
And I have to congratulate Ron Blunt for winning the Unified Taxi Workers Alliance.
They win, right? They actually do unionize itself. The song at the end's interesting, too. It's written often throughout the year, as I mentioned, they not only organize certain groups, but they want all these groups to get together to create coalitions. So they'll often have meeting spaces where the various, like, taxi workers, security officers, students get together to learn about each other's issues. And during one of these meetings they had, the security officers wrote this song for them, right? So this is a song written by the security officers for themselves. I should also say this, too, what's unique about media mobilizing is at the end of every year, December, various groups are making films, right, and making their media itself, so they create an end-of-the-year celebration, right, that they put together excerpts from all the films and other media that they make and have everybody sit down from the various groups in one room to actually see each other's struggles and start talking to one another. So they use distribution and exhibition in this case to actually have them speak to one another, right? And I should also say, prior to even making media, the most important thing is they, first of all, get people in the room speaking about their issues, right, to suddenly realize what are their main issues itself, to identify them, right? They spend a long time of just articulating what it is. And one thing I learned myself, you know, talking particularly to cab drivers and other people who are just from disenfranchised communities, right, I naively thought, you know, that, well, why don't working class folk make this stuff, you know, in some way I knew some of it, but, you know, it's not because they can't afford it, right? It's not because they can't afford the equipment. It's not because it's difficult actually to make the stuff, right? It's actually fairly easy to figure out how to put this stuff together. It's two, right? One, it's socioeconomic. Who has the time to do it, right? We're working multiple jobs at the time. We're tired. The last thing we want to do is put together a film or whatnot. But even more than that, so I knew that, right? That was fairly obvious. But even more than that was, right, psychologically, right? Why does my voice matter? Who gives a shit? And also, I'm afraid, right? So the first two things, just in the sense of, like, you know, that what I have to say is important, anybody wants to care about it. But two, even if you get to that stage, shit, my boss might see this, right? My colleague might see this. Many people I spoke to would often say, I would not have spoken to you a year or two prior, right? For all these reasons that they would tell me, right? Who, you know, you're a professor, I'm intimidated by this, you know, I don't know where it's going to and whatnot. So it's like, this is a major hurdle, right? The psychological. And you think about it, particularly in the States about working class education, you learn from a very young age to shut up, follow orders, do what you're told, right? You're regulated in an extreme way to not be reflective and whatnot. Most people, you know, if they're thoughtful, they drop out, right, often from this kind of really bad type of education system. And other people kind of get just manipulated to kind of become more complacent. So anyway, that's a real kind of issue, and it shows the strength of media making, right, quite honestly, and people talking to one another, the fact that they found their voice, literally, both individually and collectively speaking in ways, and you could see the power. And now it's interesting, so when I wrote the book, I originally started writing about media mobilizing in 2010, 2011, and I do somewhat update it, but now media mobilizing is run by all the people who actually started getting involved. It's run by the workers. It actually is a successful organization that all the people who founded Media Mobilizing Project have went to the sides to make the space for these people. And although they help out, they've went on to other projects. So they've been one of the big things. I think Media Mobilizing is a really interesting organization, is that they understand that the only way you can make this stuff sustainable is by creating a new leadership all the time, right, of the people who are involved. And so they wouldn't have professional people come in, but make people do it themselves, but also create a support structure there so that, you know, they applied for grant monies and things like that that would make it available to make it sustainable, to pay people also, I should say. That's a big, I think people should get paid for their labor, you know, I'm like a big believer. I don't believe this. I mean, of course we do volunteer stuff here and there, and I understand the point of that, but if we want to make a sustainable organization, right, with working class folk, you need to pay these fucking people, right? Somehow or other, that makes it sustainable. I don't. One thing I've learned throughout my historical study, right, is how many organizations collapse because of that very thing, right? That it's just not a sustainable thing. Not because people aren't invested or people don't want to do it, but it's just really difficult, right, to make it kind of a sustainable thing. So I got an argument during the World Social Forum in Montreal just recently last summer because people were still idealizing kind of free labor. We can get into it. I mean, maybe you can disagree by all means. So I just want to bring this up to the present, yeah? Like, and this sort of ends the book, but really it's my new project that I'm dealing with on state repression and media activism, you know? And I'm looking at various groups, Muslim Americans and how they're being surveilled on social media and the resistance to that, animal rights activism, and the states are trying to create this, they have created these ag gag laws, making it not illegal for animal abuse to occur in factories and whatnot, but to film it. The filming of the abuse is made illegal in the states, but there's an interesting thing going through trial and hopefully going to the Supreme Court that will happen. Counter some protesting and protesting, trying to make that illegal. And then the final thing, cop watching, right, in terms of cop watching and community organizing. And so I want to talk about that because I've been doing that work recently, and I do a lot of work in Brooklyn and Bronx and Harlem, you know, the New York City area, and particularly with Puerto Rican groups. I don't know why that happened, but it just happened when I got into those groups. I'm from the Northeast, too, so it kind of allows a certain access to it. And I want to highlight one group in particular. One thing I want to say, though, with cop watching, right, at least in the States, it gets fetishized as just a bunch of people of color, whoever they might be, Puerto Rican, Latino, black, who just go to the streets and kind of roam around and follow the cops and keep them accountable. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, right? Usually this cop watching is only a part of a much bigger community type of activism going on, right, at the time. And I'm going to show you a brief video, too, about that. So, for example, in New York City, which I'm primarily looking at, and I know it's a unique setting compared to other cop watching groups across the United States, and I'm sure here I'd like to hear what's going on. But cop watching in New York City is very intimately tied up with anti-gentrification fights, right? Of people being priced out of their neighborhoods itself, as well as kind of self-autonomy and representation. You might have heard about Bill de Blasio, supposedly the liberal mayor of New York City, which is very far from the truth, right? He hires William Braddon, the founder of Broken Windows Policing, which is one of the most awful policies of policing ever, where it believes if you bust people on minor infractions, it's going to prevent felonies from occurring, which has been proven not true whatsoever. By New York City's own Office of the Attorney General, just this summer, put out a report that goes, there is no evidence for that whatsoever, which of course made the New York City PD go crazy about it itself. But Braddon, de Blasio, the supposed liberal mayor, first thing he does is hire the worst fucking cop ever to be the chief of police for it. And also, I should just say, de Blasio's in the ass pocket of gentrifiers, right? Big time. And real estate is massive in New York City, and de Blasio's awful in terms of that stuff. Also, he has no representation about Latinos and African Americans. Representation to the city, right? So Latinos in the city are about 37% of the population. He has like 5% on his representation of his board and stuff and whatnot. And so on and so forth. So I wanted to talk about this group, one group, El Burrito de Sunset Park, that's located in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, which is just south of Park Slope. Park Slope, you might have heard of, is ground zero of gentrification, right? This is where all the hipsters go, and none of us can afford to live in Park Slope at all. And the state's money, the average, and there's reports on this, but the average salary of somebody in Park Slope is making about $150,000 a year, which is a pretty good sum. The average salary of somebody living in Sunset Park is about $34,000, right? So massively different. And as you can imagine, the demographics are rather different, right? Park Slope is largely white now. Sunset Park is a majority Asian, and then Hispanic, and then a small percentage of Hasidic Jews, right, are kind of a part of that itself. So there's an organization, El Burrito de Sunset Park, that started out, once again, a really kind of grassroots things. They became a 501c3, a nonprofit, just recently, like a couple of years ago. But really, their original organization happened is, in New York City, there's a big Puerto Rican Day parade that occurs every year that goes on in Manhattan. And where Sunset Park is, so there's Manhattan here, and Brooklyn's down here, right? And there's a little bridge that connects it to there, as well as the subway lines. So we'd go down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, right? The official Puerto Rican Day parade.
A few weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. Exactly, yeah. So the official Puerto Rican Day Parade would go down Fifth Avenue, and it'd officially end then. But because there's a high Puerto Rican population in Brooklyn, it'd carry over in there, right? And it'd go to places like Sunset Park and whatnot, where you'd have, like, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of this thing. And police violence was rampant, right? I'm talking, like, 2000, 1999. I won't show you videos of that, but you can look up on Facebook El Grito de Sunset Park, or one of its founders, Dennis Flores, F-L-O-R-E-S. He has a lot of stuff on there. You can see it yourself. So there was a need, right? There was a need for cop watching coming out. This is before all the major things. I should say, in the States, a real major transformation was the death of Eric Garner, right, in 2014. That just galvanizes a massive amount of groups at that time. And I'll go into that at the end. But they were already doing it. And I should say, this is interesting about El Grito de Sunset Park, too. And I want to emphasize it. They come out of longer organizing struggles, too. And this is my thing of tying older histories. So, for example, really, you could tie the origins of El Grito de Sunset Park. Dennis Flores is around my age, his mid-40s. He was a gang member back in the 80s, and when the crack epidemic was very big, and he would not deny he was involved in gangs and stuff like that. What pulled him out of it? This guy, Richie Perez, right? Who is Richie Perez? Richie Perez is one of the guys engaged with that group I mentioned before, the Young Lords. Right, so the Young Lords form in 1969 in New York City. They kind of dissolve in 1973 for their own internal things. This doesn't get rid of the movement, though, right? A lot of these Puerto Rican organizers go into these other movements, and Perez and this other guy named Panama get into these other organizations. What does Perez do? Start anti-gang organizing, right? To pull these street youth out of gangs and put them in more productive things. So he meets Dennis Flores in the late 80s, early 90s, says, why are you guys killing one another, right? Why are you fighting one another? We should organize against police violence in the 90s, right? With Marley Graham, you might mention that, remember that name from the late 90s. So Flores gets politicized in the 90s by people like Panama and Richie Perez and carries it over, right? So this is this hidden history that suddenly, if you are from the outside, it seems like, oh, El Grito de Sunset Park suddenly emerges in 2012. Wrong, right? It has long historical linkages two earlier things. This is what I was talking about, why it's important for us to study this stuff, to show, right, the long organizing struggle that goes on behind the scenes that we don't often see. Now, you all know, right? It's difficult putting together the stuff, like doing dinners and organizing a space like this, right? All the hidden labor is a tremendous amount, and the longevity of your bookstore, like, speaks to it, right? The decades of labor put into this, and what, how long has this existed? For about a decade, this downstairs thing, or right? I totally get, right, the amount of labor that goes into that stuff. So anyway, El Grito de Sunset Park, as it starts off as a cop watch organization during the Puerto Rican Day Parade, because Dennis is part of the community, and he starts galvanizing with other people, some people who are organizing in Latin America who move actually to Brooklyn, they start creating a wider organization of finding people's local struggles and what's going on and whatnot, right? So it become a bigger thing of anti-gentrification fighting, and I won't go into all the details of how, once again, de Blasio is trying to screw the poor by affordable housing, which is not affordable at all for any people in actual marginalized communities, right? The average, I'll just say quickly, the average price that de Blasio has for what's affordable housing is affordable for people in kind of middle class areas. But if you're in a working class area, this is way beyond your price range. And even worse, it's a fucking lottery. So you're not even guaranteed affordable housing. You have to put a lottery in, and maybe or maybe not, you'll get it. Right? This is what happens when you privatize housing, right? As opposed to having state-funded stuff itself. So, and they've engaged in many successful struggles of actually trying to and I'll say even worse, just one more thing. I know I'm really engaged in the struggle myself, but you can't tell these guys. But also, the affordable housing only lasts for like 50 to 100 years and then gets jacked up to regular market rates. So it's not even like permanent. It like goes away after like 50 years. So they have been engaged in struggles where, like, such as the level goes down, there's no way in which it gets, you know, accentuated up, but it's still kind of problematic. So anyway, they're very deeply involved in the community. So I wanted to focus on this one thing, the Sunset Park Wren Strikers. And just to kind of show this brief video that Dennis does, as well as the Facebook page. So there's these two buildings within Sunset Park that are being intentionally run down by the landlord, right? This is a strategy in New York City, as well as London and places like this, where you have rent control, right? So it carries on from tenant to tenant until you can kind of get the tenant out. They can't jack up the rent, right? They can only keep it at a certain percentage itself. So there's a strategy of landlords to just make the place decay to a certain part that you have to force them out. Right, so this was occurring in Sunset Park, and these two buildings itself, And already these rent strikers got together. Rent striking, I should just state the obvious, right? You just refuse to give rent, right? That the conditions are so bad, you refuse to give rent to the landlord until that person fixes the conditions itself, right? And it starts in the year correctly here. 2012, right? The rent strike starts. And it's a fortuitous year for the rent strikers, so they don't know exactly what they're doing. So guess what? Occupy Sunset Park is occurring, right? And suddenly El Grito de Sunset Park is forming, right? And many, as you can imagine, many of those organizations overlap with people who are part of it. So they team up with the Sunset Park rent strikers because they need to strategize much better of how they're doing it. But even better with El Grito, they're people from the community. These are not outsiders, right, that are kind of getting engaged. And just three people I want to highlight. So one is this guy, Dennis Flores, who's a founder of El Grito de Sunset Park. What his main skill is, he's a media maker. He's a good one. You'll see it here with his three-minute video. So he knew how to strategize around this, around Sunset Park. Right? In other words, like, you guys can't just rent strike. Like, you need to access the media, have the commercial media come here. He said, we're going to organize an art exhibit where we show your pictures of how shitty conditions you are and put it in a major museum, the Brooklyn Museum they do it in, as well as create this video that he does, as well as Dennis was there to translate for these people because the majority of them were Spanish language speakers and did not know English. So he would kind of mediate between him and the media. There is another guy called Claudio de Gaeta. He works for the city itself, so he knew how to negotiate the bureaucracy of the city and start to try to sue the landlord as well as get health inspectors down there to do it. So he kind of knew the strategy of doing that. And then there's another guy called Jason de Aglia, who was an organizer in Latin America, so he knew how to strategize and organize the rent strikers together, right, to kind of speak, meet weekly, right, the nuts and bolts of organizing. So you have these three components, two who are founders of Grito de Sunset Park, Dennis Flores and Jason, and Claudio sort of like is a part of the El Grito, but not. So I want to, first of all, before even showing the video, just to give you a sense here, they created a Facebook page. And I'm sorry it's getting cut out a little bit. This is just because sort of the weird aspect ratio that you guys have compared to my computer. But you can see here, there's a bunch of stuff posted with it. This is the video I'm going to show you in a sec. But you can see, like, giving updates. So they're using, this is the thing, too, I just want to say that the book's really big on. Because, as you know, like, the media fetishizes social media stuff, like the Twitter revolution, or like as if social media does this stuff, and it doesn't, right? We all know this. Social media helps, and internet technology helps you organize, but does not do the organizing for you, right? You have to be on the ground, speaking to people, face-to-face, right? That's how you create real relationships. That's why I like doing stuff like this, meeting people and, like, engaging things, right? So although I don't want to deny it's not an important factor to help organize people and get messages out there, it's not as important as other people pretend it to be, right? And that book my book tries to moderate that notion, right? Of both, like, not fetishizing technology, but also there's kind of like the old dusty left that thinks this technology isn't important at all, which is fucking stupid. And I'm part of an organization that's like that, quite honestly. My union is morons when it comes to social media, and I'm a communication scholar, so I get really frustrated with that side of it too, where, like, well, we don't need Twitter at all. We don't, like, really? No, you do. You actually do. But I agree, right? So it's like this sort of in between. So this is where I stand, like, sort of like it is an important thing to galvanize. You can see how they're using it here to mobilize people. But, and particularly people in my field, they're lazy, quite honestly, a lot of them. So they want to act like this does the job of it because they don't go on the ground talking to people. Right? In other words, to know all the shit that's going on behind the scenes, you have to actually go to the scene and talk to people. And it's expensive. It's time consuming. I mean, I don't want to guilt people. I'm lucky. I have a job that allows me to travel and actually spend time doing this and creating relationships with people. So I'm privileged that way, for sure. But at the same time, it's our responsibility, if we're going to write about this stuff, to write about it, like, well. You know what I mean? Like, do the research or don't write about it, quite honestly. Don't just kind of fetishize this stuff. So anyway, there's this stuff that exists here, and it is important to a certain degree itself. I just wanted to show the video, too, of the way, it's only 3 minutes, and the way in which Dennis is so economical in the way in which he presents this video, so he kind of encapsulates the conditions that these tenants are in a really amazing manner. And it's unlike a lot of other videos. Even the taxi driver video is pretty good, you know, quality-wise, but you can see just his professional nature in terms of the way this video is edited and kind of the quality of, you know, of it going on. Compare it back to, you know, the first video we saw of the People's Church, right? Granted, the technology was worse, so the technology is better, but you can see much more kind of media-making people are getting involved now. Dennis is an interesting person, and unique in that, and he's in a unique position that he's both a member of the community and also trained in media, right? That's a rare combo to have, and also working class, and came from a rather deprivileged kind of background, self-served time and this and that before. So it's a really unique thing. But in many ways, him and people like himself, like who are doing this, is showing, right, literally how this equipment is getting in people's hands that would never have access to this 10 years ago. Forget about 20 or 30 or so. So let me just pop it up. And then I'll end. I know I'm going. I get excited about this. I like showing you guys this stuff, though, right? Hold on, I'm sorry. Let me just fit it to the window screen. Here we go. It's good stuff, right? It's like, and there's much more in the book if that's anything to sell. I'm a worse seller of my own stuff. Okay, here we go. Damn it, it just overblew. I'm sorry. My bad. That's good enough, right? Oh, thank you. Yeah, I know it's a little low.
Aquí vive una familia, este es parte del mismo. Una familia con niños, una persona embarazada pronto para dar a luz. Al frente de esta puerta hay un basement lleno de basura, infectado de ratones y de pulga. Esta es una injusticia. Ningún ser humano debe de vivir de esta forma, pagando una renta demasiado alta y con muchos problemas en el apartamento que el landlord no ha querido reparar o reconocer de que esta familia necesita neveras. Les mandan neveras que no sirven. Sus comidas se les han dañado porque el landlord ha decidido no mandarles neveras. Hay niños que van a la escuela, cuando amanecen no hay leche porque la leche se les dañó o porque la nevera no funcionó.
For your health, having to read all this in, or just for the quality of living, or
why? I consider buying my health, the quality of living, and everything else, because we is problem here. There's a lot of mice. We infect here with all kinds of bugs down here, and we're not supposed to live like this.
Okay, so the positive of that video and sort of the organizing that went on, they did get the health inspector in there, and they did clear out all that trash that you saw in the basement. It took five dump trucks to clear that out. Five dump trucks of all that shit in the bottom there. And they started kind of successfully suing the landlord. However, right, this is New York City, so what's been happening is the landlord suddenly sold the property, the Freedom, and then a new landlord came in, which they sued, who flipped the property in 6 months, and a new landlord came in, who they sued. So as far as I know, they're still on strike to this day because they can't get a landlord in there long enough to be accountable for the living conditions that they're a part of, right? This shows sort of both the promising thing of this kind of activism and the limit of it also, right? And that there's a way in which landlords can strategically do this. And I just highly recommend, there's a Neil Smith book, I can't remember the name of it, but he talks about revanchism and sort of the way in which landlords strategically do this, right? Many people want to portray slumlords as being negligent. They're not. They're strategic, right? They're very smart in terms of what they're doing, right? This is a long policy that they're doing itself, which they're kind of suffering from. So I want to end, I always hate this, but it's sort of on a more down note. Although a lot of, I should say this, there's a lot of, I'm generally optimistic because I'm on the ground studying this stuff, so I think there's a lot of stuff going on all the time that people are unaware of, right? I see a lot of grassroots activism occurring. In some ways, it's a good thing. Although I see a lot of defeats and stuff, nonetheless, people are mobilizing. Even same thing with the Sunset Park rent strikers. It doesn't mean they're giving up. It doesn't mean they're not kind of trying to re-energize and whatnot around what was going on. But before we become too celebratory, right, of how, like, the access of this kind of new media to certain disenfranchised groups, particularly working class people of color, right, is what we're talking about, at least in the States, there's a severe limit of it too, right, of the lack of infrastructure to make this stuff sustainable and whatnot. So I want to briefly talk about Ramsey Orta. I don't know if you all know who he is. Do you know Ramsey Orta? You do, but you're unaware of it, how you do, right? You do. Because remember Eric Garner? He's the guy who filmed Eric Garner, right? Right. So he was the guy there. And this is the thing about Orta, right? He's a really interesting guy. He's very celebrated in New York City. First of all, I should just say, on the very same street corner, Orta filmed a woman being beaten by a cop the week before Garner, actually with a truncheon, which never made it to the news itself. So he filmed the famous sequence of Eric Garner. And I'll just say, I don't tend to show those videos. I think there's real problems of people like just kind of circulating that image. I don't think we should censor ourselves, but at the same time, I think there's something deeply problematic of constantly circulating that imagery and the trauma it sort of enacts. So I don't really actually talk about that. I'm really debating that in this new book I'm doing about state repression, of even if I'm going to kind of like highlight the speak about the videos directly or sort of just indicate them and speak about other things that are less seen, like things like this. But anyway, Ramsey Orta was a street kid, what they call a hood rat, in New York City. Not politicized at all, had no idea what the hell Black Lives Matter was, had no idea of Cop Watch whatsoever, right? Had no idea of the concept of Cop Watch. When you talk to Orta, why do you film me? Because my best friend's being killed, right? This is what led Orta to film this stuff. He had no idea what he was in for, right? What happened? The repression on Orta after he filmed that was massive, right, by the police. And I should say this is where it problematizes sort of, particularly people who want to have more liberal views. Orta was no saint, right? Orta had a long arrest record prior to this time. He's a working class kid, Puerto Rican descent and whatnot. Definitely, right, had his own problems. So we don't want to, like, portray him as an angel. And people are trying to help out Orta, particularly people in Sunset Park. We're trying to hook him up with a lawyer. There's a group called We Cop Watch, which you might have heard of, that's trying to create national networks of cop watching. So, for example, when Ferguson happened, We Cop Watch came out there and tried to arm people with video, you know, with digital cameras. They did the same thing in Baltimore also. So there was attempts to help Orta out, yeah, with it. But nowhere near the means of which the NYPD was going there to screw him. So I should just say, long story short, Orta's in prison now for 4 years, right? Because of that fucking video that he made and the lack of support that he had from it, with it. And also bad decisions, for sure, also. But also he was just tired, I'll say, right? He was constantly tired of being harassed by the cops. And I've talked to a lot of the more recent groups of like, well, what the fuck, right? I mean, is there some? I go, yes, so part of the argument of a lot of cop-watching groups is there's two fashions of cop-watching. One, professional cop-watchers out there, right, who will be a part of the community and kind of demonstrate what to do. But two, they want to see this culture become, everybody feels comfortable to pick up the phone and, right, film things when cops are doing it. But I go, well, what about Ramsey Orta, right? Here's a kid who picked up the phone, filmed it, and now is serving 4 years in prison. So, right, where do you, and then I should say, I had this conversation after I'd gotten to know some of the groups, right, I don't bring this up straight up with it, but I'm like, do you guys feel, like, culpable, right, like you're telling people to do this stuff? And they're real mixed, right, like, on one level, they're like, we have barely enough money for our own organization to do stuff, but I'm like, at the same time, you're leaving people hanging. And before we make Orta special, this is the only part I want to kind of read here. In the States, it's been consistent that everybody who's filmed cop watching has been harassed by the police, right? So I'll just go down the list of names as of date, right? Taisha Allen also filmed Daniel Pantolello, the guy who killed Eric Garner, itself, and she was arrested on March 2015 for supposedly being in a park after dark, you know, making up a type of thing like that. And this is at least what she says, quote, the cop told her that arrested her, you're that little girl from the Eric Garner case, right? She also posted a video and whatnot itself. Chris Ledet, who posted the video of Alton Sterling being shot to death by the police, was detained the next day by the police for dubious reasons. Abdullah Mufali, who uploaded the second video of Sterling's death, was also detained by the police for 4 hours as they searched his convenience store. Diamond Reynolds, who streamed Philando Castile's murder, was held for 8 hours in custody for no reason whatsoever. Kevin Moore, who filmed the police tackling Freddie Gray and shoving him into a van, was arrested and then released without charges itself. And it goes on and on. It got so severe, I don't know if you followed this, The Guardian did a good job, actually, of covering this. 40 documentary filmmakers came in defense of people who do cop watching, saying there has to be a major change in this because the police are clearly targeting itself.
Some of them died as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this raises the whole thing, right, in terms of the accessibility of this technology, which is definitely happening. What means when you don't necessarily have the infrastructure, right, to create this thing? Or how do you have to build that infrastructure? That's the little thing I just want to leave on, right? It's a very promising moment where we have this technology and there's a lot of movement building going on. But we really have to think of, like, what it means to create a sustainable kind of movement to help people, right, enable them for this type of... It's easy to say about democracy and the democracy in media, but what does it mean for us to actually support those people that are engaged in the struggle? So I look forward to hearing from you all. Thank you for listening to me blab on for it. I want to hear about your experiences and stuff. I mean, if you have questions, by all means, ask, but I'm also curious.
You know the video with the black woman speaking, like in the 60s?
Yes.
Can you get like access to that?
It's tough. It's like a really expensive set I had to get my university to purchase.
Yeah.
If you gave me, well, the problem is because you guys have a different way. I'd say I'd burn it for you, but you have to have like American, you know. If you can play regional U.S., I could probably burn it for you if you send me stuff. But because it's really expensive. A lot of that stuff, like that comes from a set that's like $2,500 in the States. So I don't know, would it be £2,000 or something here with it? And a lot of the stuff's not available. I had to go to Chicago to this place called the Video Data Bank, where... I'll just say this is an interesting thing. Video, although it's a recent technology, you know, like 60s and 70s, we lost a majority of those tapes, right, from the 60s, 70s, and 80s because it's stored under bad conditions. The tapes deteriorate really quickly because they're magnetic. As you'll know, like, all our CDs and DVDs are fuck all, right? They're going to be dead. If we have videotapes, they're screwed too. But, right, it's actually a magnetic image on there that gradually deteriorates regardless if we use them or not. So to actually resuscitate those tapes from the 70s, and also I should say they're half inch, 3/4 inch, so they're played on things that we don't have access to.
We may not be able to access what we're recording now because the technology changes so fast.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's quite worrying to me,
it is.
Anyway.
I know, it's the good thing about the tapes is they're on tapes, right? So there's a physical presence to that, which you're right. Now it's like, I mean, it's funny, even my wife makes fun of me, but like I carry around a 35mm camera while we're traveling around the UK because I'm like, I want to remember this shit. And I know, I mean, I do it with my digital camera too, but I'm like, that 35 stuff's going to stick, right? Like, I'm going to actually have it in physical box, you know, afterwards. I'm with you on that.
I've made loads of films of my little nephew, so when in 20 years' time, they might want to watch them, but I'm wondering how, just to, I've been saving them and I've had to pay out for different leads because my I just had a different lead on the hard drive.
Yeah.
It's been really difficult.
Yeah. No, it's tough. And you'll hear horror stories too, but just like, you know, activists are tired of holding the tape. So I mean, I remember once there was a woman, I won't mention the name, but you know, who was part of indie media, and she like was talking at a talk or something and said, oh yeah, I had all this stuff in my attic and I just threw it all out, like a couple hundred tapes, and I'm like, like, really?
Yeah.
Really? Like, you couldn't have just went to the university? Somebody would have taken that, you know, which just is like, because that's the grassroots stuff. I'll say the one thing I really feel lucky about, I didn't talk about it in the book, but in Eugene, Oregon, there was a big eco-activist scene in the 90s and 2000s. Maybe I'm sure you're aware of this. I don't know if you're aware of this. They had a public access show weekly that ran from 1997 to 2007, and all that shit's documented at the University of Oregon. So I went out there with two of the people who founded the show and went through, like, I couldn't go through all the tapes. It's like, whatever, 600 or something. But at least to the major ones, whoa. Like, to watch a scene build and then break up, right? Because this occurs before, I should just say, when Seattle happens in 99, Eugene gets flooded by people, right? Becomes the anarchist mecca of America in 2000, 2000. They're not ready for it, right? Like, they're not ready for the scene. But you're watching this eco-activism form in the 90s, build to the early 2000s, and then dissolve by 2003, both through internal tensions like sexism and as well as FBI infiltrated, right, this scene. But, like, as a historian and just an activist, too, like, seeing that was fucking brilliant, right? I mean, like, it's so powerful of seeing that stuff. And like, they did such a good job, you know, of, like, actually, that's a rare example of, like, where... I'll say, my wife knows the story, too. I was, you know, I interviewed a lot of people from Eugene, and one guy's like, yeah, he's like, he said it years before I went. He's like, yeah, we're, like, chronicling all this stuff and putting it at the U of O, and maybe have an enterprising graduate student, you know, who wants to do this. And, like, how did, like, I'm stupid, you know, quite honestly, and slow. So it took me about 2 years to be like, fuck the graduate student. I want to go. I should go, right, and look at this stuff. Like, what am I thinking? Right? You know what I mean? Like, took a while to dawn on me of, like, what goldmine this thing was. Thank God I did. So I went right before I wrote that chapter, and it was like just... And also I got to meet the people, too, right? It was another excuse to refamiliarize me. They had a big party for me in Eugene. It was just awesome. Eugene's great, I should say. If you ever go to the States, Eugene, Oregon, it's known as the Little Berkeley. You should definitely go if you're going up there. Yeah, because a lot of people from the Bay Area live in Eugene. It's a very kind of hippie-ish, like, they threw a big-ass party for me. The archivist, which is, like, rare, right? Yeah.
Yeah, out in the woods.
Out in the woods, yeah, yeah. Hey.
You know, you were saying about the tensions, I think you said, between black and Jewish people.
Yeah.
For gentrification. Mm-hmm. Like in Spike Lee's films, he talks a lot about conflict between like black people and Italians.
Right.
Is that the same sort of scenario, gentrification and that same issues?
Yeah.
And do you think his films are reasonably realistic?
First, Do the Right Thing is great, right? I mean, if that's one of your things, right, that's like just one of the best films I've ever seen. So yes, right, that is very on mark. I mean, the thing is, though...
You know, in his film, like, he doesn't really talk about Jewish people, though, right?
No.
Are those all people all mixed up in the same area?
Not in the area where he was talking about, Bed-Stuy, right?
Where were you talking about?
Where I was talking about, it's a different area than him, yeah. So yeah, so Bed-Stuy is largely Italian-American and African-American, right? Where I'm talking about in Sunset Park is his very small percentage of Hasidic Jews, but they have a big, they're very powerful in there, but it's largely Asian, largely Latino, right, the area I did. But, I mean, the thing is, too, there's also a lot of groups working together, so I should just say this with the...
I mean, because what you're talking about, like the video activism, it's quite a small thing in general, isn't it? I mean, in terms of audience, how many people see it. I mean that by... Harrison, Spike Lee, like Do the Right Thing, that's mass media,
right,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He gets a huge audience.
Yeah. You do nothing, right? I mean, this is the thing. So I would say, like, I agree, right, that we just had this debate. I was in New York City for a media activist conference. So a lot of people, I was like one of the few who are not a media maker. I mean, I am I'm a writer, but I don't make videos.
Is it like he's, in a way, he's taken the video activism by sort of fictionalizing it and making it, because he makes a very palatable story.
Yeah.
You know, beginning.
It's a different thing, right? It's a different goal, like, in that, we were talking, you know, I think of video activism, the stuff I'm talking about, is very narrow casting, right? So in other words, it doesn't matter getting a big audience, it's getting the right audience, and then you kind of galvanize off of it, which I think you're right. Whereas somebody like Lee gets a big audience, but then they do nothing, right? They just go to the theater, see it, say this is horrible, and then leave. You know, it's not like really organizing around it, so... But it's an important film, too, right? I mean, that's going on, but... Yeah, my people... So I said something, you know, I'm really coming to this belief, like, because some of these media makers do have these delusions, in my mind, to, like, getting these mass audiences. But at least in the States, I can't speak for you all out here, but the States, you know, I've been saying it long enough, I believe if you want your stuff mass distributed, it somehow has to be racist, sexist, colonialist, or something to get it mass distributed. There is no other possibility than that to do it.
What do you think of Do the Right Thing, then? What's sort of the problem with that, then?
What's that?
You're saying it's got to be either racist or colonialist or something.
Right.
So in Do the Right Thing, is that got...
It is problematic. I mean, the film is not, you know, I mean, it has its issues with it. But let's put it this way. Yeah, Do the Right Thing... well, first of all, let's say this, too. Do the Right Thing is only could happen at the moment it did, also, right? In other words, when it kind of came out. Spike Lee is an exception to the rule. Let's remember, he owns his own production company. Yeah? 40 Acres and a Mule Jack. So, you know what I mean? Like, let's put this in mind. When he did Malcolm X, I don't know if you remember this, but the company refused to finish it. He had to go to the black community, like people like Bill Cosby, who I know about everything, but you know, Oprah and whatnot, to actually fund the rest of that film. Yeah. So Lee, and that's when Lee started forming his own production company as a response, because he knew that his films, and remember, this is the moment, the late 80s and early 90s, is where black culture was being fetishized, so you have all these gang films that start coming out that allowed Lee to do that. So there's moments, I think, of rupture where you can actually mass distribute things, but I think it's the exception to the rule, right?
So you don't think that's possible now?
No. I think, well, let me put it this way. I think it's always a possibility, but you shouldn't aim your entire project on it, because more often than not are failures, meaning you have to change your film in a way that pisses off the people you originally made it for. I do a couple examples in the book. Or you change it, piss off the people, and it never gets distributed on top of it. Right? So it's like, it's a real holy grail, you know? Like, so I'm not saying it's impossible, but to put your eggs in that basket is a really dangerous project, because the historical conditions only happen once in a blue moon, right? To actually allow that to kind of happen.
There was a film made relatively recently in Liverpool about asylum seekers called Grow Your Own. And that happened. Apparently, the original script was very...
Yeah.
But most of it got changed in the motion.
Yeah, look at Gasland, right? Here's another... I just met one of the producers. You know Gasland, right? The anti-fracking film with Josh Fox. So, you know, it was originally supposed to be a 10-minute film. I didn't know this. I just learned this recently. It was originally supposed to be only a 10-minute film for the people in the Delaware Valley, New York, Pennsylvania, and whatnot, for an anti-fracking campaign. It galvanized enough interest that it started becoming a lead, you know, a feature film. But also, I think Gasland is imperialist. Like, it focuses around a white guy who tends to be your narrator throughout. Like, it fits into all these patriarchal ways in which Hollywood films operate. So although the producer of the film was like, oh, well, we luckily struck lightning. But I'm like, you had the right form also. Right? You had a lead white guy who was amusing, who played banjo. It focused around largely heterosexual couples, right? You were hitting all the right notes to get that thing distributed. Focus on something that has a woman in charge of it or no narrator that focuses on, right, more marginalized communities, and that would not have blown up the way. Another interesting example I wrote about, but I'll quickly, was Whale Wars. I don't know if you all follow that at all. This bizarre show that Paul Watson did, the Sea Shepherd Society, on one level is real victories, right? I mean, that show actually, his efforts did stop fucking, right, hunting for whales in the Antarctic, right? I mean, he actually stopped short and actually got the International Whaling Commission to pass a law that way. But if you watch that show, too, it's deeply sexist. Deeply racist, and for the American perspective, it's almost reliving World War II, because the Japanese are the evil people, seen at a distance, and then it's all the Americans inside. And here's the funny thing, there's one season that has Whale Wars Scandinavia. What do they do with the Scandinavian people? They go into their houses, learn about their families and whatnot. So it's interesting, when the opposition's white and Scandinavian, you learn about their family, you learn about the historical backgrounds. When they're Japanese, you have a long-distance lens and keep them on the other boat. Right, and lob, you know, your smelly chemicals there. So the other thing that just is solidifying mine is that Kony video that came out, that awful Kony video that just blew up. And it's this white savior guy who goes into Africa to save the black children, you know, and see Avatar, another film that fits into this kind of model of the white guy going to save purple people in this one and sleeping with them and whatnot. Right? This is a time but true having a white dude who, you know, comes in and saves it. So anyway, I've been really having this discussion with other filmmakers, you know, about this, of like, you know, what kind of distribution do we want, right? Like, how big of an audience, how small of an audience, and whatnot. I've been kind of...
So are you specifically aiming at sort of anarchist consensus decision-making type?
I'm not, but that just happened to be, like, the formation of this. So I should just say, like, a group like the Sunset Park Rent Strikers, they don't know anarchism at all, although they're operating somewhat on some levels like that, you know? Well, in other words, they're just kind of grassroots organized, but they understand a lot of inherent grassroots organizing is anarchist, right? In other words, it's, you know, talking to people at the local level, getting them engaged and whatnot, they're not consensus-based by any means, I should say. But they are direct action, they are kind of very kind of grassroots, so it's sort of like hybrids, you know? I'm looking at groups that self-identify as anarchists all the way to groups that don't but might have some kind of practices. But I'm more concerned with how local movements use this stuff, right? Local communities and stuff. I don't focus so much on individuals as I focus on groups. You know, I think it's important to kind of focus on the more nebulous stuff that's difficult. It's in my field of film and media studies, everybody writes about like directors or this and that, which I like. You know, I mean, it's good, but it makes it like about that person's film, and I really wanted to be more about like a social movements film, like a social formations type of like, and also what else is going on in that community to make it possible, right? To make those films possible. And you can see the taxi worker one, it's not always ideal conditions, right? In other words, that dark part where they're kind of counting the votes and stuff, they're just filming, and it sort of shows a DIY attitude, right? They're like, we're not going to wait for good conditions, right? You have to film the damn thing because we're actually doing the votes. The taxi worker one's really interesting because I feel the mode of production of the film, in other words, the DIY attitude of the film, reflects the DIY attitude of forming their union. Right? It actually provides a model through the filmmaking to show what you have to do to kind of become autonomous, right? And have a sense of self-determination.
Well, because, like, you know, I was talking to you. Well, you know, because of what Marshall McLuhan said about the media is the message, and that, I can't remember the name of him, but the guy who did Gonzo Journalism.
Hunter
Thompson. Because that's what he was getting at, wasn't he? He was saying, like, that. And I notice that when you read, like, fanzines, they're often just written in that way, where it's the interviewer and whoever they're interviewing, and it's just a straight, you're just reading, as far as you know, a transcript of the actual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you read, like, The Guardian, it's always, a lot of it is actually about the journalist who's writing, isn't it? You know, you don't get very much of the words.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, on this video stuff, it's just, it's the equivalent, it's like Gonzo video work, isn't it? Film work, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I look at a lot of his grassroots, you know? I'll just say, just because you mentioned McLuhan, he was really influential on people like Paul Watson and Earth First and all stuff like that. So that's actually a way where it becomes really tangible, because McLuhan was very obviously theoretical in the book he wrote. But like what Earth First did, what Sea Shepherd did, what he does well, quite honestly, in something like Whale Wars, is you have to create image events, right? He calls them image events, using it off of McLuhan. One of them studied under McLuhan, actually. I forget one of the founders of Earth First. I'm sure you all know the name. I can't remember his name. Bob something. So in other words, you have to create image events that galvanize people and create images. So what's the most famous image you can think of? Earth First, particularly. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Earth First. What you call it? What is her name? It's not Earth First, but the image of like a harpoon, a ship going, like a little boat going between a whale and a harpoon. It's before Sea Shepherd. It's
Greenpeace.
Yes, I'm sorry. Greenpeace. The founder was a student of. McLuhan. So, right? So, that's a good image, right? Of, like, that would galvanize people, right? In terms of, like, why would somebody put their body in front of a harpoon and whatnot? So,
are you saying that they knew that would make a good medium?
Yeah, absolutely, right? And like, give it this way, Paul Watson, in spite of his problems being a sexist and kind of a patriarch and all these things, which he is, right? He's smart media-wise. I mean, he got Animal Planet to create a goddamn reality TV show based on, I'll just say this, just to show what a prick I am at times, but I teach a class on radical media and whatnot, and I had a student, I mean, I learned so much through my students, right? I feel really privileged. So this was like years ago, and a student goes, we're talking about Watson, what a prick he is and all this stuff, and, you know, and Sea Shepherd, and the student goes, I think there's a show out there called The Whale Wars, and I'm like, no way, no way, right? I'm like, just blowing her off horribly. Like, no, I think, no, man, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, just a total prick. And so I go home, you remember, I get my wife. I go home and I see on TV, God damn it, there is a show of Whale Wars. And of course I come back, you know, I teach it once a week. I go back, I so apologize. At least I apologize. I'm like, I fucked up, I'm sorry, I was wrong. You were so right, you know, about this thing. Because I couldn't even comprehend, I'm such a cynic at times, that this would actually be a thing. So it showed, and of course the irony is I wrote about it. Thanks to this student, I would have never been aware, and I wrote about this sort of phenomenon. But, right, it's a really, it was a fascinating show that way, because it was both so problematic on so many levels, but also, like, you know, doing some tangible difference in terms of animal rights, right? It really got at that series of contradictions that the show...
Well, they got a ship named after Brigitte Bardot, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I know. Anyway, we can go on with that. Yeah, I know. It's a really fun show.
Bob Barker,
I know, my poor wife had to watch all this stuff with me, ignoring my daughter, like, plowing through well.
I think you've got a weird situation at moments, like, obviously, like video cameras and phones and stuff, especially like, when you're like on the front line saying the phone's direct action or process and stuff. We've got everyone video now. I reckon like this all goes like Bamboozle or Facebook, etc. I think you get to the point where you've got like more of you actually videoing these things than you actually have watching these things.
I know.
Yeah.
And then when you've got like all these like different laws, like the state gets more totalitarian. So like you've got like all like wearing a couple of like dispersal laws that you can't have face coverings on, different things that you can't do, you can't step outside like a certain protest.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like as we get more and more people filming and putting these things on the internet, and the state have these more like rights and laws like encroach upon our liberty and use these things actually against us.
Yeah.
I think maybe you might be actually stepping towards an area where like all this filmmaking actually might be like counterproductive to what we're actually doing.
Uh-huh.
So they can actually use these films that people are making themselves to actually criminalise people who are part of these actions. And it's like, where do we go from that? How do we do, what do we do? Because
put masks on.
Yeah, but they can still get you on that. It's like, if you've got, I think I can't remember,
Section 16,
something like that, and you've got a special, and you've got a mask on, they can arrest you for that.
They happened a few weeks ago, they got the first person, didn't they?
All you have to do is take your mask down for a second, they've got you, and they can put your mask back up, and as you told you, and that's it. They can arrest you on that.
But they can,
it's
called facial recognition.
Right, yeah.
Last week, I think it was the first ever arrest of somebody because they could just tell by one eye or something.
I've been in the custody suite before, I've had a picture taken before.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have been arrested, have had the picture taken before, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And once they've got that, once you've got your finger, they've got a record of it. If they want to know who you are, they will know who you are and what you're doing.
It's like, what
do we do? Because obviously you want people to get up there and film things to show people, because it kind of does, like when you see these films, it kind of does give you a bit of inspiration, like, people are doing it, you can see it, and it's like, then at the same time, people are going around doing it all the time, it's like, they're going to use it against us. I'm like, it's kind of like weird, kind of like new stage where you weren't at, like 10 years ago.
Right.
I mean, in the media and all that came out, it was new, so you didn't know how to counteract against that.
Snowden, right?
But now they've learned how to use that against us, you know what I mean? So it's like, where do we go from there?
Yeah,
maybe get them on our side.
Yeah.
More of them.
Well, I'm always thinking too, we should definitely film a lot. We really need to think our relationship to social media, right? That's a big, you're totally right on that. I'll just say too, just going back to that Eugene, Oregon archive I mentioned, University of Oregon archive, they're smart, because you actually had a permission to go into that archive, precisely because you could find people culpable of crimes that they did based on that show. I had to get approval. I luckily created a relationship with the people who made that show, but I forgot about that key thing, that they were really savvy, that the cops could go in there, right, find things later, and da-da-da-da. So you had to have approval in there. So I think you're getting right at the heart of this thing, right? I don't have the answer here, but, like, definitely we need to think our relationship to social media in a way that hasn't been done before. Honestly, I don't know how tied you guys are into, like, media activism, but at least on the ground level I'm a part of, there's a lot of talk of trying to rebuild an independent network server that would not chronicle your stuff like indie media in some ways, but different, because we can't we can't recreate the past, and that would be stupid, right? In other words, the ultra-globalization movement has changed from whatever it was. But there's a need, right, of like older activists who've been part of indie media really getting uncomfortable with this social media stuff. I mean, you don't forget about posting all the videos, just having all your friends listed as your friends.
Yeah.
What the fuck, right? I mean, you're just giving the
idea.
Social media is so good,
but you can still use that as a way of like finding out who was there,
when
was there, and it's like, well, kind of like that, just like what do we do? Because it's so good to use, but how they can use
it's a generational thing too. I'll say there's an interesting book that just recently came out. I don't think it's great, but I think it's good if you're really into this. It's by Paolo Garibato, who's, I think he's out here actually in England, called the Flag and the Mask, right? Which is, it sort of juxtaposes the global justice movement of the late 1990s, 2000s, to what he calls the protest of the square, right? The more recent type of things.